My name is Ethan Morrow. In the late spring of 2013, when I was just 17, I had obtained some fireworks through a casual acquaintance from school. He had mentioned them offhand, as if discussing something as mundane as a homework assignment. The small sum of cash needed for the exchange came from the hours I'd spent working at a 7-Eleven, a job that offered little more than minimum wage, but enough for such impulsive purchases as a teenager. No questions were asked about where the fireworks came from. I simply handed over the cash behind the gymnasium, and he handed me several triple-wrapped grocery bags. The transaction was swift and carried out with a complete lack of formalities. That evening, myself and two of my friends, Nick and Ryan Miller, a pair of brothers I'd met several years ago in middle school, drove to the outskirts of North Highlands, an area of Sacramento where the city's vibrancy seemed to dissolve into the shadows of neglect. It was a place marked by empty lots and buildings that had long ago given up hope of renewal. At the time, it seemed like an ideal location for our first experience with explosives. We found a clearing near a row of abandoned houses, their windows boarded up, the structures themselves leaning into decay. The silence was punctuated only by the distant hum of traffic about a half mile from our secluded spot. As we unpacked the fireworks, each piece was wrapped in layers of newspaper, the text smudged and indecipherable, adding a layer of mystery to what we were about to do. The fireworks themselves were a mix of rockets, Roman candles, M-80s, and a few larger mortars that promised a display of light and sound far beyond the mundane sparklers we had known as kids. Nick claimed to have experience with these kinds of fireworks, a boast that at the moment seemed to lend us a false sense of security. However, as he unwrapped each firework and his brow furrowed in concentration, it became clear that his confidence might have been overstated. He turned each firework over in his hands, inspecting them as if hoping they would reveal their secrets to him. It was a quiet, tense moment, watching Nick pretend to understand the mechanics of what we were about to do. I couldn't help but feel a twinge of skepticism, wondering if we were really capable of setting these off and still going home with 10 fingers. Eventually, Nick managed to set off some of the smaller fireworks, the ones that required little more than lighting a fuse and stepping back. They shot into the air with a hiss, bursting into a few sparks of color before fading into the night. It was underwhelming, to say the least. The explosions were more like whispers against the backdrop of the vast empty lots, and the colors seemed dull, barely piercing the darkness. The poor performance of the smaller fireworks naturally shifted our focus to the larger mortars, which we had initially reserved for the end, fearing the intensity of their blast might betray our presence. Impatience, however, overruled caution. We huddled around the mortar tube, a makeshift council of amateur pyrotechnicians, each of us throwing out guesses on how it might work. "Maybe it just drops in?" Nick suggested, skepticism in his voice, his earlier confidence now a distant memory. We placed the mortar on the ground, stepping back with each attempt to light it, only to find the fuse too short or our courage too thin. It was a comedy of errors, each of us taking turns to feign bravery, only to retreat at the last moment. At last, I was able to spark the fuse. I jerked my hand away as soon as I saw the fuse take light, knocking the mortar onto its side at an awkward angle. The mortar took a direct route, towards the direction of one of the abandoned houses nearby. It somehow managed to fly straight through one of the broken windows, taking a bit more glass off as it went. For a moment, it seemed like there would be no climax. Silence hung in the air as the mortar landed somewhere in the second story of the house. My brief thought that it was a dud was interrupted a few moments later when the series of explosion caught us off guard. The house lit up like it was the host of a rave as the lights and sounds seeked escape through the few unboarded windows. As the final echoes of the mortar's wrath reverberated, a sinister glow began to consume the house. It seemed as if the building itself was eager to succumb, catching fire with a speed and intensity that defied logic, as if the very air had turned to tinder. The three of us stood, momentarily transfixed by the ferocity of the blaze, a primal fear rooting us to the spot. It was the realization of what was unfolding before us, a disaster of our own making, that jolted us into action. Without a word, we turned, running back towards Nick's car, the urgency of escape rendering everything else irrelevant. In our frantic departure, the remaining fireworks were abandoned, forgotten relics of the night's folly. The car's engine roared to life, and we sped away, the growing inferno lighting up our path on the unlit road leading back to the highway. It was only a few days later that the police arrived at my door. Apparently, not long after our escape, the fire department had arrived on scene to find that the fire had bled into some neighboring houses. Among the ashes, firefighters found the fireworks we'd left behind, each bearing serial numbers on the packaging. With this information, they were able to trace the transaction back to a store in Tahoe City called Tan Hide Smoke Shop. From there, police were able to obtain the name Mark Horvath, the fellow student who had sold me the fireworks. Unsurprisingly, Mark named me as the buyer, sealing my fate with just a few words. As I was being placed in handcuffs within the doorframe of my own home, the police described to me how firefighters recovered three charred bodies from the home that we had accidentally set ablaze. The bodies were that of three homeless people who had been using the home as a place to shelter at night. There was no anger or accusation in the officer's voice, just a blunt delivery of facts that pierced deeper than any harsh words could. In that moment, I understood the retribution that would follow. The court process that followed was a blur of legal jargon and stark realities. My lawyer was a seasoned and pragmatic man who urged me to fight the charges and to name my friends in exchange for a lighter sentence. The thought of reducing my sentence at their expense felt like a betrayal of my own conscience. I chose instead to face the consequences, a silent acceptance of responsibility for a tragedy I could not undo. Being only 17, my case fell under juvenile jurisdiction, a fact that provided little solace. In the end, the judgment was as inevitable as it was harsh. I was sentenced to 7 years, the first part to be spent in a juvenile facility until I turned 18. The youth correctional facility in Stockton, California, became my world, a place of structured days and restless nights, marking time until my 18th birthday. Upon reaching legal adulthood, the transition to an adult prison was swift. I was transferred to San Quentin State Prison, a name synonymous with its daunting reputation. This shift from juvenile detention to the stark, oppressive reality of adult incarceration was a jarring rite of passage. Each day, a monotonous blend of routine and reflection, a constant reminder of the cost of a moment's indiscretion. As the years marched by and my release date approached, anxiety took hold, not so much about freedom, but the uncertainty that awaited beyond the prison walls. The thought of struggling to find employment, coupled with the prospect of possibly returning to my parents' home after everything that had transpired. My cellmate, a man named Jakub Karzynski, provided a peculiar form of distraction. A Polish immigrant who had arrived in the early 2000s, Jakub was only 2 years my senior and had, over the 9 months of our shared confinement, offered numerous, often conflicting, accounts of his incarceration, from a failed robbery to an outlandish claim of being set up by his mother. While I learned to take his tales with skepticism, his mention of wildfire firefighting jobs in California caught my attention. To quote Jakub himself, he described these jobs like the French Foreign Legion, he said. He detailed his plan to join their ranks when he was released and their indiscriminate acceptance of men with criminal backgrounds, due to the job's inherent risks and high casualty rates. Eventually, I sought the advice of the prison's employment counselor, a bridge between incarceration and re-entry into society. He confirmed what Jakub had told me about the firefighting opportunities, noting their need for able-bodied individuals, regardless of criminal history. Surprisingly, he suggested that committing to this path could expedite my release, a proposition that rendered my decision straightforward. The promise of immediate employment, combined with the chance to avoid returning to my parents' home, was compelling enough. The opportunity to start afresh, to somehow make amends through service, even in a role fraught with danger, seemed like a path towards redemption. This revelation shifted my perspective, turning the daunting prospect of freedom into a focused plan of action. By August of 2018, my initiation into the ranks of the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection was complete, and I found myself stationed in Placerville in El Dorado County, where wildfires were not mere possibilities but certainties, their occurrence as regular as the seasons. The land, parched and waiting, seemed to hunger for flame, and it was here, amidst the towering trees and dry underbrush, that I found myself. I was dispatched for the first time in September to confront a blaze near Pollock Pines, a fire that would later be recognized as one of the most formidable conflagrations California had faced in over a decade. The fire's intensity was unmatched, its behavior erratic and unpredictable. Fueled by a combination of low humidity, high temperatures, and Diablo winds, a meteorological phenomenon that exacerbates fire conditions, this inferno rapidly outgrew its initial containment efforts. The fire's spread was facilitated by an abundance of dry fuel in the form of dead trees, thick underbrush, and a bark beetle infestation. In the morning, we descended into Pollock Pines, the landscape increasingly besieged by the fire's wrath. The air, thick with ash and the acrid sting of smoke, painted a dire picture of the encroaching inferno. Our company was split into trios, tasked with the Herculean effort of carving containment lines through what now seemed less like forest and more like fuel for the unrestrained appetite of the blaze. I found myself paired with Jamie Conway and Parker McKenna, whose tenure in the profession spanned decades. Their careers in firefighting were as distinguished as their military service, both having served as Marines during the initial invasion of Iraq in 2003. In the brief period I had been shadowing them since my training concluded, their openness and willingness to mentor me had been unexpected. They told me many tales of the mistakes that previous firefighters had made on the job, most of the time costing them their lives. These stories did not, however, seem like cautionary tales, nor something to scare or motivate me. They were told more matter-of-fact, like the weatherman reading a forecast. They seemed to let me interpret these stories however I wished. The tales often involved what Jamie and Parker termed glory firefighters, a moniker reserved for those who ventured into wildland firefighting without the grounding experiences of military service or a firefighting background, and also without the blemishes of a criminal record. These were individuals drawn to the fire lines not by necessity or a call to service, but rather an ill-conceived notion of adventure or the allure of heroism. According to them, this naivety was not just a personal folly, but a liability, a risk magnified by the capricious and often merciless nature of wildfires. They described how these glory firefighters thrived in controlled simulations, only to seize up in the chaos of a real wildfire. Separated from the disciplined order of military service and firefighting, or the desperate survival of those with a criminal record, they faltered. In the face of the fires, the mere option to do something, anything other than what they were currently faced with, became too tempting. I began to sense that Jamie and Parker viewed my criminal past not as a liability, but as a sort of twisted reassurance. To them, it was a mark of commitment, proof that I was devoid of any alternatives, not here merely to prove my mettle. One particular story that stood out was the account of Taylor Rigsby, a firefighter who started with the company back in 2015. Despite initial skepticism regarding Taylor's motivations and prowess as a firefighter, he quickly distinguished himself with an exceptional display of aptitude and skill during his initial deployments in the field. Parker recalled an incident that occurred in the dense area of Shasta Trinity National Forest, an area notorious for its wildfires. During the containment phase, something had possessed Taylor to deviate from his assignment and venture alone into the heart of the fire. 30 minutes passed without a word from Taylor over the radio as the rest of the company battled the fire from the perimeter. It took another 45 minutes to get to the point where they could even consider safely entering the area that Taylor was last seen. That was until Taylor's voice finally broke through the radio. He had claimed to have discovered children amidst the fire, expressing a determined vow to lead them to safety. yet as time stretched on, he failed to reemerge, prompting a search and rescue operation. What they found was a scene of horror. Taylor's body was recovered, severely burned, an expected tragedy given the circumstances. But it was the inexplicable detail of his scalping that cloaked his death in mystery, a grim aspect of the story that Parker seemed reluctant to go into detail about. Despite my failed online search attempts to corroborate this rather unbelievable part of the story, I couldn't help but believe that Parker was not lying when he told me this. By 10 a.m., despite having reviewed our strategies exhaustively before our departure, we found ourselves once more congregated around a rudimentary table upon which maps of the surrounding territory were sprawled, marking the encroaching fire's current extent. These maps bore symbols denoting the assigned sectors for each trio of firefighters, a silent testament to the scale of our operation. I was allotted a particularly daunting area, known locally as Whispering Canyon. Nestled between the steep inclines of two mountains, this canyon was infamous for its dense forests, with vast stretches of towering pines and thick underbrush. Our assigned task focused around trying to carve firebreaks at the forest edge, a preemptive barrier against the fire's advance towards another untouched expanse of wilderness. The endeavor demanded we strip the land of its natural armor, removing brush, trees, and any vegetative fuel in the fire's path, crafting voids in the greenery where none had been. It was a task of deliberate destruction, creating swathes of barren earth to starve the flames, a calculated sacrifice to preserve the greater whole. The trek to the precipice of Whispering Canyon was about a 1.5 mile hike that took us over half an hour. Upon arrival, we conducted a brief radio check on our designated broadcast channels. With a mutual understanding, we dispersed, each claiming a 1/4 mile of frontage as our own battleground against the encroaching flames. I began to clear the underbrush at the forest's edge, an act that felt almost futile, a mere gesture against the towering inferno that loomed ominously a mere 1/2 mile away. The absence of wind was a small mercy, holding the blaze at bay, allowing us some time to fortify our defenses. With my back to the approaching fire, I initiated a series of controlled burns, wielding the drip torch with deliberate precision. Each patch of vegetation I set alight was intended to deprive the larger blaze of its potential fuel, a countermeasure as strategic as it was dangerous. As the flames from my torch devoured the underbrush, small movements in the depths of the forest caught my eye. This provided me with some relief. The thought that perhaps another crew was already at work inside the forest's edge, engaging in their own preparations. After 30 minutes of clearing vegetation, weariness set in as I climbed a small rise. The ground underfoot was a mix of dirt and charred remains, evidence of our desperate efforts. At the hill's crest, Jamie and Parker's figures vanished into the haze. After a few minutes of clearing this new territory, the wind's sudden change caught me off guard, quick and cold, stirring the air. It carried the fire towards me, a sudden, hungry advance, quickly eating up the area that we had just finished clearing so diligently. Embers flew chaotically, some catching on my gear, their brief heat a warning of the encroaching blaze. I was left with but for one option, to retreat into the forest that we were meant to protect. Under the canopy of the forest, the world dimmed, cooler, but no less dangerous. I scanned frantically, hoping to spot Jamie or Parker or any of the crew that I thought I had seen through the tree line earlier. I tried the radio, but only static replied, confirming my temporary isolation. I adjusted my course south-southeast, aiming to intersect the route we had taken earlier, hoping to cross paths with Jamie, Parker, or any member of our company. The forest seemed to disorient my sense of direction, requiring me to consult my compass every few dozen yards as if the trees themselves were subtly altering my course. Eventually, I emerged into a clearing, a space where the canopy still reigned overhead, but the underbrush had been meticulously cleared. At first glance, it bore the marks of human touch, perhaps a temporary campsite prepared by one of our own. Yet, as I ventured closer, the truth of what laid here became clear, and any notion of familiarity vanished. Before me, in two solemn rows, lay empty graves, each marked by sticks crudely fashioned into tall crosses that reached hip height. I halted, my heart pounding, the forest silence now a pressing weight upon my senses. Cautiously, I moved forward, each step measured, my eyes scanning the clearing for any sign of life, any indication that I was not alone with these silent sentinels. The earth around each grave was meticulously tended, the arrangement too orderly to be anything but recent work. Intrigued and apprehensive, I felt a compulsion to inspect the graves closer, to understand the intentions behind their preparation. Yet I found myself restrained by both time and a lack of courage. Ahead, the path seemed to swallow light, a stark contrast to the forest behind me, which flickered ominously with the encroaching glow of the wildfire. I committed the location to memory, despite the futility of doing so without any real sense of my bearings in this unfamiliar expanse. Venturing deeper into the forest, my certainty waned with each step that I would reunite with anyone from my company. My mind replayed the tales Jamie and Parker had shared, of firefighters who had succumbed not to flames, but to their own faltering spirits, immobilized by fear or seized by panic. Reflecting on their words, I couldn't help but fear a similar fate befalling me. By all accounts, I should have emerged at the forest edge by now, close to our point of departure. Yet, when I consulted my compass, it mockingly confirmed I had veered off to the north. I cursed myself for neglecting to monitor my course, lost in my own thoughts. The sole consolation in this moment of disorientation was the realization that I had outpaced the fire a bit. Its visible threat had vanished, leaving behind only the haunting scent of smoke as a reminder of the peril laying just beyond my sight. In the dimming light beneath the trees, I strained to recall the maps we'd scrutinized during our debrief, the contours and landmarks now blurred in my mind. Jamie had been the custodian of our sole map, its details now frustratingly out of reach. I attempted to reconstruct my whereabouts, considering the unintended detours my steps had taken. Stagnation was not an option. Movement was necessary. Thus, I set my bearing due south, a direction chosen with the hope of correcting my course. For 15 unyielding minutes, I pushed on through the dense underbrush, this time with a vigilant eye on my compass, ensuring it never slipped back into my pocket. Just as I considered pausing to gather the fraying edges of my composure, the forest abruptly opened up, revealing a vast clearing. My progress halted, primal instinct taking over as I absorbed the sight before me. The clearing unveiled itself as a theater of the surreal. Children, no more than 9 years of age, moved with an eerie sense of purpose. I found myself retreating, seeking concealment behind a tree. My gaze was drawn to the complex array of ropes and pulleys the children had rigged at the base of the trees. They worked in unison, seemingly oblivious or undeterred by the slowly approaching fire, which was now visible in the distance. Some of them wore what looked like scalps placed loosely on their heads. I stood rooted in disbelief, time stretched, warping as I struggled to comprehend the scene. It was only when my gaze shifted upwards that a visceral fear gripped me. Suspended 30 yards above, bound to the trunks of the trees, were firefighters. Some appeared alive, others not. I could make out the figures of Jamie and Parker in one of the trees that stood farthest from my position. I watched the children, with unsettling efficiency, maneuver more of my colleagues into the canopy, individuals easily 3 to 4 times their own weight. The mechanical advantage provided by the pulleys and the intricacy of their setup belied their innocent appearance. Every instinct screamed for me to step forward, to use the axe I carried, to cut them down from their arboreal prison. Yet, the sight of those scalps, worn so casually atop their heads, rooted me in place. Fear, thick and palpable, coursed through me, a visceral response to the incomprehensible scene before my eyes. I stood as a mere spectator for several more minutes, barely daring to breathe before I finally felt the wall of fire approaching our position. I knew it was time for me to decide if I was going to intervene or go the rest of my life, pretending I had not seen what was right before me in this moment. Driven by neither reason nor bravery, I stepped into the clearing. I had meant to announce myself as I entered, but my voice caught in my throat as I saw just how many children there were. They seemed to notice me right away, but curiously, most of them did not stop their work. Only a few ceased their labor, turning their gazes towards me, giving me a sense of quiet acknowledgement, almost as if they were expecting me, almost as if they accepted me. Clutching my axe, a surge of anger overtook me as I witnessed the children unflinchingly continue their task, hoisting my fallen friends towards the sky as if offering them to the encroaching flames. Their indifference to my presence shifted as I liberated my axe from its restraint and approached one of the trees, where a firefighter, already succumbed, was suspended. A singular, decisive swing severed the rope, and his body descended with a definitive thud to the ground. One of the children, indistinguishable from the rest, spoke with a voice that did not match his stature. "You have already made 3 offerings to the fire. Why do you seek to take ours?" Confusion, anger, and fear swirled within me as I struggled to grasp how he could know. The others watched me silently, unmoving. I turned my head toward the fire, my mind melting, unable to put my body into flight. One of the children approached me and handed me a scalp. He silently motioned for me to place it on top of my head. As I did, he spoke his final words to me. "Watch us burn."